morning and welcome. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In order to carry out the policy of this lodge, this local branch has a program consisting of various activities. On Sundays from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, there's always a panel or forum presented following a particular theme of the month. Now, the theme for April is Symbols and Myth. And today's talk is entitled Easter, the Symbol of Spiritual Rebirth. On April 11th, there will be a forum, The Power of Symbol and Sound. And April 18th, a panel, Battles, Ramayana and Mahabharata. And finally, on April 25th, there will be a talk, Allegories of Plato. Now, all of these Sunday morning presentations are always followed by a time for questions and discussion. Now, on Wednesday evenings from 7:45 until 9 o'clock, there is always a class in the Ocean of Theosophy. Now, this coming Wednesday, April 7th, the class will begin the study of cycles. And it is taught that cycles is one of the most important studies of theosophy in that it relates to every moment of man's life and lives. Also, on the third Friday of each month, there is a special class dealing with comparative studies of religions and philosophies. And for April Friday, April 16th, the presentation is entitled The Cross and the Tao. Now, these meetings begin promptly at 7 o'clock and last for 1 hour. The doors to the lodge are open at 6:30. Now, on Saturday, April 17th, there will be a symposium held at the National Constitution Center at 6th and Arch Streets. Now, the theme of that event is Ancient Messages for Modern Times. And this will be a cooperative effort of three lodges, Philadelphia, New York, and Washington. For further details, we suggest you pick up a pamphlet, or a flyer rather, on the table just behind the usher. Now, the reference library is open each Wednesday from 5:30 until 7:30. It carries a straight line of theosophical literature consisting of books, pamphlets, and magazines, all comprising the original writings of the founders of the Theosophical movement. During library hours, assistance is always available. in helping to locate references as well as answering questions. And also during library hours, you will find a reference in connection with the evening's talk. Now, all activities of this lodge are free. ULT has existed for 101 years by voluntary, independent devotion, and voluntary contributions to the cause of theosophy. All contributions are needed, such as time, money, and service, and all are most welcome to participate. Today has been selected from the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is speaking. Both I and thou have passed through many births, O harasser of thy foes. Mine are known unto me, but thou knowest not of thine. Even though myself unborn of changeless essence and the Lord of all existence, yet in presiding over nature, which is mine, I am born but through my own Maya, the mystic power of self-ideation, the eternal thought in the eternal mind. I produce myself among creatures, O son of Bharata, whenever there is a decline of virtue and an insurrection of vice and injustice in the world. And though I incarnate from age to age for the preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness, whoever, O Arjuna, knoweth my divine birth and actions to be even so, doth not, upon quitting his mortal body, enter into another, for he entereth into me. Man, many who were free from craving, fear, and anger, filled with my spirit, and who depended upon me, having been purified by the ascetic fire of knowledge, have entered into my being. In whatever way man approaches me, in that way I assist them. But whatever the path taken by mankind, that path is mine, O son of Bharata. Those who wish for success to their works in this life, sacrifice to the gods, and in this world, success from their actions soon cometh to pass. Mankind was created by me of four castes, distinct in their principles and in their duties, according to the natural distribution of the actions and qualities. Know me then, although changeless and not acting, to be the author of this. Actions affect me not, nor have I any expectations from the fruits of actions. He who comprehendeth me to be thus is not held by the bonds of action to rebirth. The ancients who longed for eternal salvation, having discovered this, still performed works. Wherefore, perform thy works even as they were performed by the ancients in former times. Even sages have been deluded as to what is action and what inaction. Therefore, I shall explain to thee what is action by a knowledge of which thou shalt be liberated from evil. One must learn well what action is to be performed, what is not to be, and what is inaction. The path of action is obscure. That man who sees inaction in action and action in inaction is wise among men. He is a true devotee and a perfect performer of all action. Those who have spiritual discrimination call him wise, whose undertakings are all free from desire, from his actions are consumed in the fire of knowledge. He abandoneth the desire to see a reward for the action or his actions. He is free, contented, and upon nothing dependent. And although engaged in action, he really doeth nothing. He is not solicitous of results, with mind and body subdued, and being above enjoyment from objects, doing with the body alone the acts of the body, he does not subject himself to rebirth. The subject of the talk for this morning is Easter, the symbol of rebirth.
This is a wonderful month to study the theme of myths and symbols, because we know that from time immemorial, there are certain uniformities, there are certain universalities of myth and symbol that speak to our very hearts. And while some may look at, say, a bas-relief sculpture on an older building and say, gee, isn't that a pretty design? There are others of us who seem to be doing nothing in the moment, but standing there in front of these symbols, our minds are expanding tremendously. And it is in the symbols like today, the symbol of spiritual rebirth, that for millennia, humans have presented messages to those who will follow them, messages of discernment and imagination and creativity, messages and symbols that help to light the fire of curiosity and intuition, and at the same time, symbols that contain in themselves and hold for all of posterity the spiritual reality of what it is to be human, what it is to be the microcosm of the macrocosm. And having said that, you know, we may sound a bit Gnostic this morning in that, you know, we're inviting folks to read symbols intuitively and to read even words symbolically. We know that the messages involved are embedded in the symbols of Easter, so that like the ocean of theosophy, at the lowest limits, even a child can respond and understand to the symbols, while at the tremendous depths, like the ocean of theosophy, it is possible for the most advanced of adults to find these eternal messages and to feel the spiritual uplift, if you will, of those messages. So everywhere this weekend in the Western world, there are folks observing the Easter traditions. And again, that would be the Western world, not the Eastern Rite. And for the perspective of someone just getting their toes wet in the ocean of theosophy, from the perspective of the child, what kind of symbols are presented and what might be the messages evoked in the tiny child, somebody who's pre-seven maybe someone who's approaching that age of wisdom. We know that for many children in the Western world, there's the tradition of taking an egg, hard-boiling it, making it as solid as possible. And for many children, that's a great curiosity. How can this egg sometimes be a liquid and sometimes be hard? What's the transition? The adult knows it's fire, isn't it? But the shape of the egg, the oval of the egg, the remembrance of the womb, the smooth little hard-boiled egg that rolls around in a hand, and then is dyed in many, many homes, so that now the child is learning about the rainbows of colors. The child is learning about four cardinal points and the symbolism of major colors and how those colors might complement each other, how they may actually be blended. In many, many of the Western homes, the color purple is very, very significant in the weeks leading up to Easter. And children at the egg dyeing table may play with red and blue and try to come up with just the right tint of purple that they might like. In other homes, there's a tradition of taking that egg, which is at once fragile and yet tremendously strong, the promise of life to be manifested to come, and they'll blow the contents of the egg out with a straw, very, very delicate process, and they'll see that the liquid comes out, and again, white and yellow will blend, and maybe mom and dad will talk about the colors that proceed there. So from the beginning, to a child's eye, there are great mysteries in the shape of the egg, the content of the egg, what's done with the egg after. And Those questions very, very early in life may actually linger in the latter years of life, might they? And in which case there's a gift of inquiry that's invited. What is it that's the seed of life? What's the source of life? How does life go from the invisible to the visible? What are the stages that it goes through? How's the fire process? How's heat or energy involved in that process? All those questions begin to emerge for the very young brain that's being used by mind for the first time. The egg hunt that we invite children on, where the egg rolls across the lawn, but certainly the egg hunt, they're the hidden treasures of great nature, the sparkling treasures of great nature, and how they may be found again in the springtime of the year. The same kind of messages given with the Easter bunny. Now you see him, now you don't. Where do the bunnies come from? How come there are suddenly these huge little herds of bunnies hopping around on the lawn, very, very tiny? Where are they coming from the underworld? How does life emerge again after this long, cold winter? And why now, at the springtime of the year, does this all emerge? As the child becomes older and becomes more inculcated in a particular religious tradition or religious philosophy, as the adult tends to age a bit, from the perspective of the young teen, there are other overlays of symbolism that go with this. The questioning proceeds, but the traditions of the gathering of the family, the observation of certain foods and traditions at this particular time of year, the purchasing of new clothing and the Easter bonnet and the old Easter parades that used to occur with great frequency, all of those things begin to give the teens another layer of questioning. Is that what life is all about, that annually we get all dressed up in the springtime? Well, why? And why would this be, and why would that be? And again, the whole nature of looking into the symbols, questioning what they're about, and then coming away with questions begins to be greatly, greatly reinforced. And certainly at the adult level, there's a great range of Easter traditions involved in the group that considers themselves churched or nearly churched. They're frequently the joke among the folks that are in the Christian group is that there's the C and E crowd, the people that show up for services at Christmas and Easter and you don't ever see them the rest of the year. So there's a range of belief systems, and we know also that at least 25% of the current Christian population of the United States holds with reincarnation. There is a changing kind of emphasis on the symbolism of what Easter might mean. And again, there's a range of possibilities that the symbols might bring to the inquiring mind in the adult group. If we look at the Easter story, the Christ story, in the light of theosophy, we find that there's tremendous truth veiled behind the symbols that are traditionally taught and held up at this time of year. And certainly we could approach this from a number of different ways. Without getting into side issues, we can say that when we look into the Christian traditions, whether it's the Eastern Orthodox or the Western Roman Catholic or the many, many splinter groups following the Reformation, there are certain symbols that are so universal and so metaphysical and so predate historic times that we begin to wonder if some of the symbolism of Easter is not an amalgam, literally, assumed by this particular modern religion, and then held up for the group to think about and to consider. But if we look at some of this, one would be the whole notion of Easter symbols that are prehistoric, that are pre-Christian, if you will, from before the Common Era. And we look at the date itself. Easter is one of those observations that's called a floating holy day or a floating holiday. And it's a very interesting blend of the metonic or the lunar cycle adopted by the Hebrews and certainly the Babylonians before them, and the solar cycles certainly known throughout many of the native or indigenous religious philosophies throughout the Middle East and Europe. Easter is set in the following way. There's the vernal equinox around March 20th, 21st, in which we have an equal time of sun and dark, and we know that there's a changing of a season, and that increasing angle and positioning of the earth will allow a warming and the spring will come. Life that has been hidden or latent or suspended will come again as the weeks of spring roll around. So following the vernal equinox, a solar symbol, if you will, there is the first full moon, the metonic or the lunar symbol. So first we have the sun, then we have the moon. And the first Sunday following the first full moon after the vernal equinox is when Easter is set. So Easter can fall late in March, it can fall early to middle of April. In any event, we see the interplay of an eternal light symbolized by the sun, its reflection in the moon, matter, the astral, the emotional, and the culmination of that interplay of light as it is transferred or emanated or radiated from source to reflector, we have the two of those things woven together in the symbolism of the rebirth of light in Europe. This particular scenario of thinking is not 2,000 years old or thereabouts. It is far beyond and before the Common Era. In Northern European tradition, there's an Anglo-Saxon goddess of fertility and spring, Estra, E-A-S-T-R-E. In the Greek or Hellenistic Greece, you have Persephone arising from the underworld, the daughter of Demeter and the earth goddess who emerges during the spring. In terms of the cruciform and the changing of light falling into matter and energizing matter at this time of year, we know that the symbolism of the cross is a very, very big deal in the Christian world. Well, there are other avatars, there are other messiahs in which death on a tree or death on a cruciform positioning has been taught for generations long before the Common Era. Krishna died on such a tree, pinned by arrows. The Buddha, meditating under the Bodhi tree, is said to have reached enlightenment. And in fact, the Buddha is said to have died under a tree. So we have some of the same symbolism percolating way, way back for humans to consider long, long before our Common Era. Emerging certainly by the Council of Nicaea in 325 in the Common Era, we have a blending of the Judeo-Christian symbols, which have then been carried forward often into the Western Hemisphere. At that particular council, they set the order of the days of the week as we now have them, with Sunday leading the week, if you will. And also the floating holiday that's Easter, the date of the Easter observation was set. And it was set to coincide with practices already in existence that had come from ancient times, so that whole Gentile tradition of the lunar coming together with the solar from the Romans, that whole thing is set by this particular conference. And also by that point in time, from 300 to about 500, what is known as the New Testament, not the Gnostic Gospels, but the New Testament Gospels, had all been collected and edited and put together, so that a lot of the stories of Easter and the Christ tradition were then set. And again, we're hard pressed to find any historic documentation in any of the Roman or North African or Middle Eastern governmental logs. There's no written record of the accounts that we have in the New Testament that's been accepted. So coming down to us through all the splintering of the Reformation and all the many different creeds and sects and variations of the Christ story, what kind of symbols can we find universally, if you will? Most times during the Lenten season, the color purple will appear frequently in most of the churches, and frequently we're reminded that purple can be the sign of a royal or uplifting kind of symbol. The crown of thorns is typically accepted throughout, that there's a crown of suffering involving the letting of blood. But we know that from Thursday, Holy Thursday, Friday, Good Friday, Saturday and Sunday, there's a particular story that the one was crucified, died, was buried, descended into hell, and then rose again on the third day in an ethereal kind of radiant body, if you will, outside of a tomb, and then ascended into heaven. So what do we have there? We have on Holy Thursday the ancient Hebrew culture of the Seder, the Passover. We have on that particular date a garden in which the religious teacher, the enlightened one, is meditating under the trees of the Garden of Gethsemane, on the full moon, by the way, and is then sold out by one of the 13 apostles. And therefore, the man of flesh who is meditating to approach that Buddhi nature of Buddhi Manas is turned over to the rational, the legal authorities. On Friday, we have again the rational use of mind in a court system. We have a trial that is said to happen, and then the crucifixion. What's interesting with the crucifixion is the ancient symbol of the cross, a threesome. Remember, there was a trinity on that particular mound of death. And then we have the situation of a vicarious atonement and the story of a unique Messiah coming only to a particular people. And therein, the symbology changes and takes on a different angle away from the universal teachings of centuries and millennia before. It takes on a very particular symbolism. So we might later want to discuss that fall of spirit into matter, and we've got that symbol of the round crown of thorns crowning a particular incarnation spirit, falling into matter and suffering for the uplift, the impress of all. Not unique, but a particular use of symbols. We have the symbolism of the entombment, descending into hell, the three-day entombment underground in a cave. And we're reminded of the very, very ancient rituals that appear to go all the way back to the time of the Lascaux Cave in what is now called France, in which you've got a situation where there is a religious sacred place underground. There's an initiation process in the dark in a retreat that again has a symbolism of 3 days to it. And the emergence of the initiate, radiant, enlightened, in a finer ethereal form, able to work with matter, able to possess a number of different powers, and said to be at one with their spiritual font, with the Father within. So again, we see that same tradition throughout the Easter story. What is lost from the account, certainly, is the Lost Court of Christianity, appearing a tad bit in the Gospel according to St. John, is a comment that the Christ in the ethereal body, speaking to the Apostle Peter, talks about coming again, and who among them will tarry, who will wait for the true resurrection of spirit coming again. And again, there's the emphasis of reincarnation, but that particular symbol perhaps is not as widespread, but certainly if 25% of the church Christians in the nation right now are reawakening to the implications of some of these symbols, we have great hope. Now, those Easter traditions just listed certainly go from the most child simplistic forms, very, very, very ancient symbols of coloring the eggs and considering the source and looking at fertility and looking at the springtime of a spirit falling into matter. The symbols progress through a personal kind of narrative of what it might mean to have a Messiah legend and the symbology of the suffering and the crucifixion of such a Messiah. But if human beings, theosophically speaking, are truly the microcosm of the macrocosm, there are far greater manifested symbologies inherent in this particular time of celebration and observation. So we might also, in our Q&A and discussion time, consider Easter and the symbols in the light of the cosmic or solar and lunar considerations. That annual symbol of spiritual rebirth, of the annual symbol of the sun, and the raising of the forces of great nature that goes on from December 21st straight through until March 21st, when certainly here in the Western Hemisphere in our climate we see the rebirth of the deciduous trees and the flowering substance. And we might consider that solar cycle in the light of that first fundamental proposition of absolute life in the absolute, non-configurative, most abstract way that we can imagine that source of all, at times appearing to be in abeyance or latent, and at other times periodically flowering forth in all of the manifestation of life and soul and consciousness that we can envision, truly in every array of every hue and tint of the rainbow that we can imagine. We might take these symbols from a newly repopularized word from the Avatar cycle, having little to do with the film perhaps, or perhaps having more to do with that symbolism. But we see the spiritual font, the notion that spirit is resurrected universally, that when the Manvantara, when the period of manifestation begins, there is at the most ethereal level tremendous deific essence and force and energy that is emitted from the absolute and very, very gradually begins to become more and more materialized, less and less ethereal, if you will, until finally every single degree of intelligence as we can imagine is enlightened up. It is, and then gradually becomes in every single form or manifestation that we can envision. That avatar cycle, the notion that there is a periodic cycle of appearances of great, great spirit using physical form in order to help others is not unique to the Messiah story of the Christ. It's not unique to Easter. We could in our private time trace it to Menes in Egypt, Zoroaster in Persia, if you will, Krishna Buddha in India. And again, these are tremendous individual studies that we could be doing. But always and forever in those legends of these comings of these tremendous avatars or Mahatmas, there is the notion of that one, the soul that comes into physical form, literally soul falling into flesh, a crucifixion, a sacrifice, so that all of life used by that great soul is uplifted and impressed. We frequently in the third fundamental of theosophy, we consider the notion of the pivotal doctrine. And it is said that all of nature sings and thrills when an arhan is reborn, comes again in order to serve the all. And finally, we could take the Easter spiritual rebirth, the resurrection story, and look at it from the echo of that lost chord of Christianity, reincarnation, that there is a spiritual impress on matter, that life proceeds from the invisible through all of the hidden forms, as in the mundane A, until finally life emerges from all those preparatory ethereal forms of substance, and life emerges in a sentient building, being, sometimes self-conscious, sometimes not, but life emerges in form. And that through the tremendous miracle of spiritual rebirth, it is more than possible that enlightenment can be reached by each and all, for one and for all, across the many millennia to come. I'm sure you came to this room this morning with interesting views on Easter symbolism and the spiritual rebirth theme of your own. Yes?
I've always heard 12 apostles, but you said 13. Are you counting the Jesus among them?
I'm referring to Judas, who then in the latter New Testaments disappears. Okay, but in terms of, we have benefited from modern legends and use of symbols in terms of the picture of the Last Supper, the painting of the Last Supper. And I think modern thinkers are more alert to what was the symbolism of that particular table, who were the identities of the individuals around that particular table, and what's the meaning. And again, we could play with the numbers, 13, 1, and 3, or you can add them together and come up with a 4, and you can have a lot of fun with the symbolism, literally. But also, if you look at a painting of the apostles around the Seder table of the Last Supper, the artist did this remarkable thing of embedding triangles. Again, the ancient symbol of the Trinity of mind and spirit and matter coming forth. And the ancient Trinity, certainly in the Hindu teachings of the creation, the preservation, and the destruction, all those symbols are in that particular painting. And again, it's so much fun, literally, to move through some of the religious traditions and stop and think about what's on the table, what's in a picture, why is this, and how might wine have been used in a previous culture. Then we get the bigger picture of symbols. Yeah.
Speaking about what's on the table, the egg, I have a question about that. Now, I believe it's on the vernal equinox where you can balance the egg on its side, I guess, on the narrow part of the egg. Is there any occult significance to that?
Wow, I didn't know we could balance an egg on that. I'd have to start playing with that. Hard-boiled or raw?
Raw.
Okay. Things balanced on their head, what comes to mind is it. The Hindus saying that we are in the Kali Yuga, that we are in the darkest of ages, and that everything is upside down, and that what we see as the basis of power and force and value right now is upside down. In essence, what we should be looking is that spirit is coming into us. So if we look at the Star of David, we have two intermeshed triangles, one pointing up, one pointing down. There's a great deal, there's wonderful articles in the periodicals that you can get about the nature of spirit coming into flesh and the higher eternal nature of the human trying to raise the flesh. And so that's what comes to this mind. Does anybody else have an observation of an egg being able to be balanced on its narrow side on the vernal equinox? Yeah.
The only thing we could think of is that we know that we're affected by the sun and the moon,
mm-hmm.
and that maybe with the equality of day and night,
uh-huh.
that it affects the fluids in the eggs in some way. With just speculation.
It's a possibility. How else might we see this? Yeah.
We were just listening to that. What if that is, in fact, possible? If the yolk would go drop down, it would give it like a weight. So it could possibly do that.
It could be. The balance of the sun and the moon at that point in time, I really can't say for sure, but it's a great thing to study this year. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, equinox means equal.
Yes.
So we're in a balance during the equinoxes, and oftentimes they took an egg to prove that to younger children that this is a time of balance, and you can actually balance an egg on its end.
Hmm. Very interesting. So it's a time when you can balance the egg on the end. So all the unseen forces, all of the fertility, all of the potential for manifested life would be totally in sync, in balance, in that uncracked egg. Yeah.
So does that mean we're in balance on that day, the vernal equinox? And can we take advantage of that?
Well, as thinking entities, as self-conscious beings, we have reached a particular state of spiritual potential that while in nature we can say, you know, there's more of a tendency for the instinctive to be in balance on that particular day, because we're intuitional in potential, don't we have the potential to carry the whole symbology of spiritual rebirth every single day of our incarnation? We can recreate and hold within us the meaning and the power of these symbols, hold them as ideals, and then work in a devotional, quiet way. We had that lovely reading this morning of action and inaction. Can't we balance our days so that we appear to be inactive on the passional plane to someone who may not know us well, but internally we may be tremendously spiritually active in order to maintain a balance of that outer image, outer manifestation. Yeah.
Well, to further expand on that idea, how could we celebrate Easter then in its universal sense, as opposed to the specific Christian practice of celebrating this time of year, or this event?
So, if we use our self-consciousness and we find ourselves from a different religious philosophy, we find ourselves serious students of theosophy, and we're confronted with family heritage or tradition or a good friend's heritage or tradition, we find ourselves at the Easter time of the year. As we move through all the activities of the day, isn't it possible to be a participant observer, to move through the day's activities almost as a spiritual anthropologist, a theosophical student, and observe the traditions and the customs and the foods and begin to think about what are the implications of the symbol? What might this particular food or this particular game or this particular teaching, how might that measure up to the three fundamentals? Where is the universality of the one life of all? Where's the message of cause and effect or periodicity or karma and reincarnation? Where are the implications of a pivotal doctrine that is akin to the Kuan Yin pledge, where we are to serve one and all? And how does, and in our thinking, we know that as dynamos, we begin to generate, we begin to transmit literally at so many different levels the spiritual message. We imbue the entire surroundings with that, and we might look for opportunities if there is another who is questioning. If there's someone questioning one of these traditions, we might say, gee, you know, this is a lot like what I've been thinking. I've been considering X, Y, Z, and I know that that's similar to this other custom that's thousands of years before. In that way, we're observing with our family and our friends, our chosen family, but by the same token, we are in the group, but not of it. We belong to it, and we're uplifting it to making it more universal. And again, please don't denigrate the power of thought. You can become, literally a transmitter of theosophical thinking and eternal thought in the way that you approach the observations. Yeah.
Well, one thing we think that we need to keep in mind is that at the end of the year, we always look at the significance of Christmas. And now we're looking at the blooming forth from what went before. But we don't normally talk about the one leading when we're here, talking about what came before, if we're making ourselves understood. But we think it's important to look at the whole process, that everything was underground and was percolating, just like we are currently. We haven't blossomed forth yet either. So we're looking at, if we're looking at rebirth, then we have to look at what comes before, everything underground percolating, just like we're still growing, you know, we're still learning, just like things are underground. And the end point being that we will become perfected. So
the whole message of looking at Easter from the viewpoint of the macrocosm and the microcosm at the same time is a very interesting one. There's an incredibly serious article. You can go to the Phoenix ULT site, and they have for free an article online called The Doctrine of the Avataras. And part of the article is actually 44 pages long. And just for today's purposes, frankly, I only was looking at the first 14 or so. But there's a portion of this article that you can use to do exactly what the commentator just alluded to. To look at the symbolism of spiritual rebirth, we can think about what it is to be a self-conscious entity, soul, moving from the darkness of the winter. We can do it from a personal view if we want, or we can think about it of self-conscious soul aligning with the forces of great nature and the sun and the moon, and what it is to come into a dark period of time in which the physicality appears to be dead and still, and then gradually across time moving with the welling, the forces of nature, and then coming forth more energized in the spring, ready to roll up our sleeves and work again with nature, setting harmony not only in the garden, but certainly setting harmony among our own principles and our own character development, and going with the flow of great nature. Now, we can look at that from the viewpoint of one incarnation of one personal symbol. The human is a symbol of soul going through this process in this manvantara with the forces of nature as we know them in this globe. Or we can do what this article on the Avatara talks about. It talks about the fact that there are universally groups of celestial beings, the seven primeval gods or angels, or what we know from the East as Dhyan Chohans, that this sevening comes through, and certainly we can find archangels, etc., in the Christian later variations of the story. But what's so wonderful that we can use at this time of year, from the winter, the solstice, straight through to the vernal equinox, is that the Dhyan Chohans, ethereal, the most amazing arupa, formless spirit that we can envision that come forth from the absolute, are at the upper rung of the ladder of being, materializing more and more as they descend in the scale of objectivity and form, ending in the grossest and most imperfect of the hierarchy, man. But that's man in potential. Spirit working through this human form, literally spirit crucified in this form, so that by effort, in the cauldron of blood, sweat, and tears, of using energy, going through the heat of all of the different passions, and maybe getting feverish from time to time as we slough off old diseases that we've set up of habit, but gradually uplifting, energizing that form. And the potential is that we can retreat. We can be like the egg turned on its narrow head. We can see the egg on its rounded end, topsy-turvy, kind of spinning around, but balanced on occasion when spirit is mind and matter are used with harmony of great nature, then the egg can stand on its narrow end. But germinating that consciousness, which is the earliest manifestation from causal consciousness, this descends all the way to the mineral. So if we think of that incredible guru parampara chain, spiritual rebirth coming forth at the beginning of a manvantara from the absolute in the most ethereal, formless potential of force or beingness, and then gradually lighting up like the spring forces do at this time of year, until the bloom is from the very highest to the most concrete or material mineral that we can imagine. Yeah.
To put a feeling in place at this time of year, we hear a lot of expression of gratitude. And if we look at ourselves, we see welling up within us this gratitude of being grateful, first of all, that spring is here and we're out of the darkness. We see in a lot of traditions that, you know, this is the time when those that have come before us are honored, and, you know, and there's some kind of respect shown for even us being here, and it's the earth is being renewed, and as we are being renewed, so it's like a being grateful.
And that gratefulness is symbolized also in the Seder, isn't it? The Christ, as at the time, that Gnostic transitional phase, and the Essenian tradition, all these early traditions that were not truly Christian and were splinter groups of the Hebrew, were rooted in gratitude. There was a tremendous gratitude, and again, the celebration of Passover, of being spared, with all the different symbols on the table, that's the beginning of this Christ Easter story. This gratitude that there is survival. There's spiritual survival and spiritual rebirth coming out of the most horrific, the most painful, the most limiting experience imaginable, and therefore gratitude that there's this welling, whether we take it from the most universal cosmogony level, whether we take it from the annual natural cycles on this particular globe or whether we see it from the personal issues, we know that our entire form thrills with the lengthening sun. More sunlight, less clouds, the colors that emerge from nature. All of that is external to us, but the body is responding to it. It takes mind to be aware and observant of what the body's responding to and why. Yeah.
One of the things that I've experienced, I look back at the time of my early birth, when I was first popped out of the womb and I started to do things. Three symbols I used, a circle, a triangle, and a square.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as an artist, I have to use them. And if you look back into the old master paintings, you'll see, if you can do the analysis, the design, though you can't visibly see it, it's there. The circle, the triangle, and the square, they're all used. And they're used in various ways. Now, when I first came across those, I just saw it. I don't know what it was, what was the symbol? Just a circle, just a square, and just an equilateral triangle. They can create endless variations using those. If you're an artist, you'll see these things and you begin to apply them. I was about 2 years old, 2.5, maybe 1 year, and I saw these. And so I used them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, today we've gotten very sophisticated. We have a tremendous discussion. When I saw the sun, I got a circle. When I saw the moon, I got another circle. When I saw a box, I saw a square. And then I saw other things like triangles. And I saw that they all worked together. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about the sophistry of spiritualism or any of that stuff. I just knew that I could use those symbols.
We might consider that the infant born, the two-year-old mind, and now certainly the elder mind, the person may not have an individual recollection of all these symbols and their meaning. But the philosophy would invite us to consider that if indeed we are emanations of that absolute, and if indeed we are part of the sevening upon sevening of those seven original Dian Shohans, that in that spirituality, in that mind, exists an impress of meaning. And if we think about the typical infant, one of the things that they love to do when being nursed is look into the eyes of the caregiver. And what are they looking at but a point in a circle? The nursing infant who's seeking the breast, what are they finding? A point in a circle. The symbolism starts, as was just said, in developmental stages, and even, frankly, at 90, 95, there may be thinkers among us that are still oblivious to the rational application of a particular symbol. But the symbol does exist. And in the spiritual impress, in the heart, in the intuition, in the buddhi, the message is still there. It is for mind to gradually become more alert and enlightened, to be able to line up everything that is sensed in the outer and line it up with the meaning that is internal. It's that process of harmonizing the two that is of greatest service. The speaker delivering the announcements this morning reiterated the nature of gratitude and gifts that can be given to keep the cause going. And one of the statements was to give time and service. Cash, for sure. You know, yeah, okay, the building's got to keep going. But time and service. The individual effort to be devotional, to give time to this kind of thinking. to look into the heart of the religious philosophies and the sciences, to look into ancient archaeology, to look into the process of a small child discovering art for the first time, to give time to that and study and service. Our time is up, but we have a whole nother cycle ahead in which to give time and service. Have a great day.